Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll begin in a moment and talk with PJ Crowley, who's a former special assistant to President Bill Clinton for National Security Affairs and currently a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We're talking to PJ Crowley about the testimony of Condoleezza Rice before the 9/11 Commission this week and the release just yesterday of the August 6, 2001 presidential daily briefing titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. And we'll also talk with Dr. Fela Jabbar, who's a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace. He's an Iraqi who spent quite a bit of time in Iraq recently. He was a close friend of the Ayatollah who was murdered, Ayatollah Hoyi. And, of course, Muqtada al-Sadr, the young firebrand cleric, is being charged in that murder. Apparently he was charged some time ago. And that has led to a crisis in Iraq. And so we'll be talking to... And Fela Jabbar actually met recently with Muqtada al-Sadr, so we get a sense of what he thought of this young leader who's testing the Americans at the moment. We'll also go to London to talk with Dilip Hero, who's written 5 books on Iraq, the latest being Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. I'm speaking with PJ Crowley, who's a senior fellow and the Director of National Defense and Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress. And during the Clinton administration, P.J. Crowley was special assistant to the President of the United States for National Security Affairs, serving as the Senior Director of Public Affairs at the National Security Council. And prior to that, he was a Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. So in all, for the last 28 years, P.J. Crowley has been a spokesperson for the U.S. military and the U.S. government. And this week, of course, was dominated by the testimony of Condoleezza Rice. I guess the people who support the president say she did wonderfully, and people who don't support the president say she did poorly. So where do you come down, PJ Crowley?
Well, I certainly think that while she held her own personally, I don't think she necessarily... allayed many of the questions that lingered before her testimony. In fact, I think there were a couple of substantial contradictions in her testimony that set up the hearings this week, where we'll hear from the likes of Louis Freeh, Janet Reno, John Ashcroft, and focus, I think, the first day on the past and the second day on the future. But obviously, the August 6th memo, intelligence briefing, and its title is in itself the primary contradiction when Condi Rice said it was an historical document, and yet and that the Bush administration was focused on intelligence reporting that leaned towards an attack outside the United States. But the title of this document was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States. So I think there is a major contradiction there in her testimony. And the other key element is, what was the FBI doing in terms of following up on activities of al-Qaeda cells, inside the United States? Condoleezza Rice said they were alerted. The FBI said they were not. So that, I think, is one of the primary issues that will be in the focus in this week's testimony.
But what somewhat went unnoticed was the testimony of former President Bill Clinton on the same day. Apparently, he gave them an extra hour. And in the TV clips that I saw of both two of the senior Republicans on the commission, Slade Gordon, former senator, and the former Secretary of the Navy, John Lehman, both were almost giddy in their praise of President Clinton and how forthcoming and how reflective. And so you worked for President Clinton. Why to begin with, did he testify in secret and not publicly?
Well, I think there is a tradition that presidents do not testify in public. I think
former presidents, you mean?
Well, or current presidents. I mean, President Bush is going to testify at some point in the future, with Vice President Cheney at the same time. There are a number of former Clinton administration officials that testified last week, will testify this week. I think that President Clinton was following a tradition. I don't think he was watching the clock, which was, I think, the President Bush's initial comment that he would visit with the commission for an hour. Since that time, as people have walked away from that that suggestion that the time will be limited. I think the primary issue here is not necessarily whether the Bush administration could have prevented 9/11. I think that it would have taken an extraordinary string of fortuitous occurrences for us to break up this plot. The issue really is, you know, what really was the sense of priority that this administration brought to office in January 2001. And the portrait that Condi Rice painted this week was an extremely passive White House. That notwithstanding they understood the conceptual threat that terrorism posed to our society, but they came in with an agenda of national missile defense, big power relationships, Iraq. She acknowledged that there were 33 meetings of the principals. Those are the cabinet-level folks who are responsible for national security issues before they got around on September 4th to focusing specifically on al-Qaeda. So it's hard to say that this was a priority because the facts that she presented this week and others have presented in previous testimony just, you know, doesn't suggest that was the case. I think in the case of President Clinton, one has to remember that 3 weeks after he came into office, we had the first World Trade Center bombing, and this was something that affected him then. And while he himself has said the Clinton administration obviously did a lot but not enough, still it was something that from 1993 to 2001 became, you know, the central national security focus of the Clinton administration.
And you were there in the National Security Council, P.J. Crowley. So how much, you just mentioned earlier how presidents have a tradition of only testifying in private. Well, I give you Ken Starr. That clearly violated that tradition where presidents' private testimony was shown to the entire world. At the time that he had apparently one chance to get bin Laden, where he was at a hunting camp with some visiting sheikhs from the United Arab Emirates, apparently they had people on the ground and they were ready to strike. In fact, Richard Clark talked about it in his testimony. But it's worth noting that that decision had to be made on the eve of the Senate impeachment of President Bill Clinton. And I defy you to tell me that that didn't weigh heavily in his decision-making.
You defy me to suggest that the politics swirling around the president in 1998 affected his decision?
Had nothing to do with this.
I think Dick Clark relates in his book a conversation on those lines where Clinton very specifically said, look, you know, we're going to do what's necessary. Don't worry about my situation. I think you kind of married together two separate instances here. In August 1998, we received intelligence information that bin Laden was having a meeting in Kandahar of his key lieutenants, and we did launch a cruise missile strike as an attempt to kill him, obviously. There were three other instances which Dick Clark relates in his book, one of which involved bin Laden, you know, on some kind of hunting excursion, and it was unclear whether we could successfully strike at bin Laden without potentially taking out the royal family from the United Arab Emirates, and two other instances where we thought we had a track on bin Laden, but then did not think that we had a high enough level of confidence in the intelligence. As George Tenet said during his testimony, one of the failings, we got people that were somewhat close to bin Laden, but not close enough. But it was not for want of trying. From August 1998 on, we had assets in the region, you know, prepared to strike if we did get actionable intelligence, and that never came to pass.
But when President Clinton did go after the Muhabarat in, I believe it was in response to an attempt on President Bush Sr.'s life, wasn't there a hue and cry about Wag the Dog? I seem to remember there were at many times there was both the Republican opposition and a large part of the press were suggesting that any activities on the striking at either Iraq or Bin Laden were to distract the public from his.
I think there are two separate issues here. In June of 1993, the president, after we learned about the plot to take out the first President Bush, did launch an attack against the Iraqi intelligence headquarters, and in fact, because of that strike, Clark and others said in testimony for the 9/11 Commission that effectively ended Iraqi-sponsored terrorism against the United States. But in December of 1998, after the UN inspectors were pushed out of Iraq, the president ordered what was called Desert Fox. And the results of Desert Fox were striking. Now that we have folks on the ground, they've gone back through the various locations where we suspected weapons of mass destruction, as the president says, program activities. And it turned out that we were much more successful in those strikes than the intelligence suggested, and effectively put an end, and as it turned out, perhaps permanently, to some of his weapons activities. But that happened in December 1998. You're quite right. Bill Cohen had to go up and spend a great deal of time on the Hill because there were the Republican impeachment managers who were convinced this was Wag the Dog. But we were also prepared to take that action earlier. But you'll remember there was about a six-week delay where Saddam Hussein tried to work a deal with the United Nations that turned out not to be successful. But that basically from December 1998, we were able to strike what we were concerned about in terms of his weapons programs. But we lost, obviously, the access that the inspectors had to on-the-ground ability to continue to monitor what he was up to.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with P.J. Crowley, who is a senior fellow and director of National Defense and Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress. And previously, P.J. Crowley served as a special assistant to the President of the United States for National Security Affairs, serving as the senior director of public affairs at the National Security Council. And it seems to me, though, that, and you'd be able to answer, at least in terms of the Clinton atmospherics, in terms of decision-making, particularly at the National Security Council, you get the impression from leaks from the Bush White House and to some extent from Condoleezza Rice's testimony that it's a very compartmentalized White House, that the president himself is very, very hard to get to. He's kind of sequestered, and that much of the frustration that Clark and Rand Beers and others had was trying to get stuff through Condoleezza Rice from the bottom up, as it were. My understanding of Clinton was that he was a real policy wonk and that liked these kind of discussions, and that it was a lot easier for stuff to come up from the bottom to the top. So give me a sense of whether I'm on the right track here.
Well, the response that Condi Rice had this week in a number of cases when commissioners were questioning what they were doing regarding terrorism, and Condi said, well, we were meeting every day with George Tenet. However, it's important for people to understand, George Tenet is the intelligence guy. He brings information to the president or to senior leaders and says, here's what we're seeing out there. He's not a policymaker. Richard Clark was the policymaker for Condi Rice and for the president on counterterrorism policy, and he did not have access to either the principals or to the president. And that's one of the more puzzling aspects of the portrait that Condi Rice paints, because when you say that something is a priority for an administration, there are a couple of things that are really strict measures of that. One is, how much does an administration say about this publicly? How much time does the president and his national security team spend on it directly, and what are the resources that they commit to this area? And in all three of those cases, the Bush administration claimed that this was a priority, falls short. The fact is, the president and the administration mentioned terrorism virtually not at all in various public statements, leading up to September 11. As I mentioned, the principals never met on Al-Qaeda until September 4th, and that is despite the fact that between April and August, as George Tenet said, the intelligence systems were lighting up with the prospect of a terrorism attack. And finally, during the course of the spring, as the Bush administration was preparing its first budget, John Ashcroft, Attorney General, released in the spring his strategic goals document that would feed into the Justice Department budget on counterterrorism for the FBI, and he never mentioned the word terrorism. And then, in fact, both prior to and after September 11, he failed to support funding, extra funding that the FBI requested for additional analysts, additional agents, additional translation ability to be able to discern, what the threat was to the United States. So when you look at all the measures that say when this is a priority, do you put the time, attention, and resources behind that area? And the answer is no. There was no track record within the Bush White House that this was as prominent as the issues that they brought into the White House in 2001, national missile defense, Russia, China, Iraq.
Well, indeed, there's a front-page story in today's Washington Post. Bush gave no signs of worry in August of 2001 that goes through the entire month in his schedule, and he was dealing with stem cells and other things, but there was no public mention of terrorism.
Well, that's right, and a great irony. Condi Rice was set to deliver a speech here in Washington on September 11th, when one looks at the draft speech that she never gave, it never mentioned the word terrorism. She rescheduled that same speech for a few months later, and it was a dramatically different speech.
Well, it was very difficult for stuff to percolate up from the bottom to the top in the Bush White House. I didn't get a sense, my understanding was that Clinton is a much more intellectually curious individual than President Bush is, as far as one can tell. So,
I think that's true. But I do think Condi Rice in her testimony this week said that she kept the Clinton national security counterterrorism team intact and on board after she came back into the White House. That's true. But she certainly didn't keep the priority that the Clinton White House had maintained on terrorism, despite the fact that there was still the issue of the USS Cole and how the United and who was responsible and how the United States should respond. The Cole happened in October 2000. We knew instinctively within days that Al-Qaeda was responsible. What we did not know was whether this plot could be traced back to bin Laden himself. That final determination from the CIA came about in January 2001. So there was this kind of do-out that the Clinton administration handed the Bush administration and said, it's up to you to determine what to do about this. And on the one hand, I think Donald Rumsfeld said last week in his testimony that they looked at it and decided that they would wait for a more strategic response. That's not necessarily an unreasonable judgment. But then, particularly in the spring, as the threat information reemerged about a possible attack by Al-Qaeda, there was a remarkable lack of action by the Bush White House. And in essence, when Condi Rice said, the president said he wanted to stop swatting at flies. Well, he never even swatted a single fly. In waiting for the perfect strategy, there was really no other level of activity beyond the working level activity of Richard Clark that the White House could point to this week.
Well, indeed. Last week I spoke with a colleague of Richard Clark's, who was in charge of transnational threats at the National Security Council, Jonathan Weiner, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for what they used to refer to as drugs and thugs. And he said that both Rand Beers and Clark had personally complained to him about being frustrated and getting absolutely nowhere and saying that they wanted to resign. And he urged them to stay in, you know, because of their, you know, sense of duty to the country, that the country needed you. And they basically said, look, you know, the country may need us, but we're absolutely wasting our time here. We can't get anything done. And conversely, it seems that the only time that Richard Clark had any particular face time with the president was 2 days after 9/11, where the president came to him and said, you know,
is it Iraq?
It's Iraq. Pin it on Iraq, you know. So it's not very comforting.
Well, I think one of the, structurally, one of the decisions that Condi Rice did make was to demote the focus of Richard Clark's activities from what we called a principal level focus to a deputy's level focus. That doesn't sound like a great deal, but you know, Clark and Sandy Berger, who was the National Security Advisor during the second Clinton administration, had regular meetings of the principals, the cabinet-level officials who are responsible for national and domestic security. And there was an ongoing, active focus on terrorism, you know, throughout 1999 and 2000. And it had an effect, so that it basically communicated down to various agencies, you know, the fact that this was an ongoing high level priority. Time and resources were being devoted to it, and that had the effect of drawing up the best information that was available within agencies. So the top level leaders knew what they were, what was going on, and at that level could, as Jamie Gorelick said to George Tenet, could through brute force break down barriers when necessary to make sure that this agency was communicating with that agency and there was a cross flow of information. But when the Bush administration took over, Condi Rice said she wanted to make the NSC less operational. And in doing so, she pushed Richard Clark's focus down one or two tiers. And what that meant was that at the working level, there was still communication going on, but there was never the kind of high-level focus which would have been the only way that we could have put ourselves in a position to perhaps, just perhaps, I mean, and as I said before, a great long shot, of trying to get the dots in the same room so that we could maybe put a puzzle together. And that kind of high-level focus was missing, and because of that, you had the agents in Arizona who had good questions about Middle Eastern men interested in flying lessons. You had Colleen Rowley in Minnesota focused on Musawi and trying to get a permission to crack his computer. But without that kind of high-level pull of perspective, these dots never got connected.
Well, just in closing, P.J. Crowley, the forthcoming testimony this coming week of Louis Free, my sense is that he'll be pretty much in the hot seat, because I think it's pretty true that when Louis Free came in, one of the first things he did was take the computer off his desk. He apparently frustrated the most successful FBI agent in terms of an institutional knowledge of Al-Qaeda, O'Neill, who subsequently died in the World Trade Center since he left the FBI in frustration and got a job at the World Trade Center in security there. He apparently was the most knowledgeable, and he was totally thwarted. And I understand that Louis Free wouldn't even talk to the president when he, you know, and Louis Free was currying favor with the Republicans who are impeaching Clinton. And I mean, is it true that he wouldn't even return the president's phone
call? Well, there was not a good relationship between the FBI and the rest of the national security apparatus with Director Free and the Clinton administration. That's very true. Dick Clark, in his book, expresses a great deal of frustration that while the FBI advanced some there were still major problems, and Louis Freeh will be pressed on that. There's no question about it. I think another critical area of testimony will be, by the 1999, when the FBI did do a brilliant job of helping acquire perspective that helped us break these plots against Los Angeles Airport, Boston, New York, and with cooperation from Jordan, a plot in Amman. At that point, it seemed that they started to get it. And Louis Freeh should also be able to shed light from 2000 to 2001, since he served under the Bush administration for 7 months before leaving office. What were his instructions from John Ashcroft, and what was the contrast between the instructions that he was given by Janet Reno and Ashcroft, so that he'll be one of those people that, he does have a lot to answer for in terms of cultural problems within the FBI during the 90s. By the same token, he'll be one that will also be able to help us understand any shifts in priority from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, P.J. Crowley.
Ian, a pleasure.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with P.J. Crowley, who's a senior fellow and director of the National Defense and Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress, and previously served in the Clinton administration as special assistant to the President of the United States for National Security Affairs as a senior director of public affairs of the National Security Council. I'm now speaking with Fela Jabbar, who's a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace, and he's a research fellow at the School of Politics and Sociology at the University of London, and you're an Iraqi national who has spent a lot of time recently in Iraq, Fela Jabbar, and I spoke with you earlier in the week, and you told me that the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was murdered on the steps of the Grand Mosque in Najaf about a year ago, almost a year ago today, he was a close personal friend of yours, and of course that's significant because apparently the arrest warrant that was been held for some time by the Coalition Provisional Authority accuses Muqtada al-Sadr and his lieutenant Yacoubi of that murder, and that has led to the showdown with Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. So, give me a sense of, and you also have met privately with Muqtada al-Sadr, and let's begin with your meeting with Muqtada al-Sadr. What was your impressions of this guy? Is he the anti-American firebrand that he is described in the press?
At the moment, yes, he is. But at that point, when I met him in July and August, he wasn't. He was complaining why the Americans, dislike him, why he is disfranchised, why he is this and that. And obviously he was, at that point in August last year, moaning and groaning about being excluded from the political process. And the problem for him at that point was that, one, many clerical families in Najaf rose to prominence, to political prominence, thanks to the fact that they organized their families as social movements or political parties, and they got a share in the cake or in the governing council, like the Hakim family or the Bahrul Ulum family and other families. And the clerics in Najaf are organized first as families, and then they go beyond that to city solidarities, then they go nationwide, and then they go into supranational networks of emulators and loyalists and what have you. So this guy, his father's and his uncle's names were or became, political symbols. And in his mind, I think, was this idea that if my father's name, the southern name, has become a household name, if it indicates, political martyrdom and political defiance and this and that, why should it be used by political parties, lay political parties like the Dawah Party or by other political groups? This is a family asset, and I should make use of it. And I have the right to do that. I mean, that was his state of mind, really. Now, he changed course, I think, due to this exclusion, which was mainly, but not exclusively, the making of his fellow Shi'i Islamic forces, not liberal forces, Islamic forces, Shi'i Islamic forces. So, I mean, this exclusion, I think, further radicalized him. and brought him directly into the arms of Iran. Now, he is, you know, moving between these two poles, between ideological Islam, the Khomeini school, and the family thing that he has deep down in his heart. And, you know, this kind of tormenting tendency, so to speak, in his mind and heart, you know, could further, you know, destabilize the whole situation. He might, you know, shift from the one to the other abruptly and with unforeseen consequences.
But the name Al-Sadr, his father and his two brothers were murdered by Saddam. His father, the name resonates, I guess, because the father was, in effect, the de facto head of Shia opposition, was he not? I mean,
it was not a Shia opposition at the time, actually. You know, when during the Iranian Revolution, there was, you know, there were certain small Shia Islamic groups that had either ideological Islam in their heads or some sort of communal grievances, Shia grievances of being not included or being excluded from the, you know, economic participation, political participation, what have you. Now, these groups were radicalized by the rise of Khomeinism. And the moment they were radicalized, the government was so strong. You know, the single-party system was formidable, really, you know, with 2 million members in the party, with lots of oil revenues and lots of, you know, economic prosperity. So they were more or less on the safe side, on the safe side at that point. And they could destroy these movements that shifted or migrated to Iran. And there was a vacuum. And the government wanted to relink with Najaf as the seat of religious authority for Shi'is. And they started to support Muqtada's father, in a sense, indirect support, meaning to let him do whatever he wanted within the confines of religious teaching, of piety, of you know, good conduct, of this and that. He grew massively, his influence. And this influence doubled during the years of the sanctions. People started to suffer, and he organized charities, and his popularity, you know, rocketed to the sky, as they say. And he became to be known as the Red Lion, with his red beard and with his fiery speeches. But they were all like ethical speeches and, you know, like preaching, religious preaching. They didn't have any political connotations. When they started to have some political flavor to them, I mean his speeches, the government took notice of that and eliminated him. He was killed, assassinated with his two young sons in February 1999. So he was not that political. He was, you know, he became the mouthpiece of Shia grievances, of disfranchised people, of impoverished middle classes, and he linked, extended his networks among the tribes at that time, and became the religious symbol of Shiism at that point. But his Shiism was not radical, not the Khomeini type of political radicalism that would call for the overthrow of the government and having the city of God again on earth. I mean, he was not that type of person.
Well, no, nobody in Saddam Hussein's Iraq would ever say that, any rate, would they?
Absolutely. But I mean, he had the idea that the leader of a community should not only give advice in religious matters, but also should give advice in economic and political matters. But that doesn't mean that he fancied himself for a moment to be like the guy, like Khamenei, like the guide of the republic, or having an Islamic constitution the way ideological parties do.
But the long and the short of it is that the name, the father's name, the family name resonates, and even though this son, Muqtada, apparently, I mean, I understand he's not entirely mentally stable, is he?
Yes. I mean, he had some fits of depression back when he was very young, and the traumatic experience of his father's and two brothers' assassination brought him into a sort of a self-imposed house arrest, if you like, and he remained for 4 years unable to go outside and to, you know, liaise with people. And that was a terrible experience. I could see it on his face. You could see it, anybody could see it in his face. I
mean, this is a wounded country, too. I'm saying this is a wounded country. I mean, everybody in Iraq seems to have had some kind of pain, whether it was from direct interaction with the machinery of repression under Saddam, the sanctions, or losing people in the war against Iran and the war against Kuwait and the coalition, etc.
Let's
try and just get a fix on what's happening now, fellow Jabbar.
Yeah.
Given that, as you mentioned, you know, that this young cleric is getting support from from Khamenei, the head of the Iranian Council of Guardians, the guy who's preventing democracy inside Iraq.
Iran is now
financing this, and has been financing this this young guy's shot at rattling the American cages. But you also mentioned that when you talked to him, he kept saying, "Why do the Americans ignore me?" You know, I mean, it shows how incredibly stupid our side has been here in terms of dealing with a broad base of Iraqis. I mean, they are putting together a governing council that's supposed to 11 weeks or so from now, will be supposedly taking over. And some of them are already threatening to resign because of U.S. actions in against Sadr and in Fallujah.
Yeah.
So how much of this is just ineptitude on the part of the United States in terms of this crisis?
Well, let me start with this, that the existence of private armies runs counter to the stabilization phase that we are going through, or we have been going through. And there is a strong feeling among the public at large in Shi'i areas and even in Sunni areas that private armies should not exist anymore, that they should, you know, go. Having said that, and of course the violent acts committed by these private groups, private militias, are also loathed by the public at large. They say it privately. Some people might not be able to say it in public because the others have guns in their hands. And we still don't have that kind of public opinion that could, express itself freely. Having said that, you can deal with these. It's necessary to deal with the acts of violence, to keep them in check, to bring those culprits, you know, before, you know, the law. Justice should be done. But, I mean, the method with which you do that is perhaps more important than the legitimacy of the case itself, as important as the legitimacy of the case itself. The CPA didn't advise the Governing Council of what it was intending to do. And it came as a surprise to them to have two flashing points, one at the same time, one in Fallujah, the other in with Muqtada Sadr. And, I mean, this weakened the position of the GC. And the heavy-handedness or the heavy fighting, actually, that broke out in Fallujah triggered what I call the Rocky syndrome, meaning that, a weak guy, a small guy being beaten up by, a stronger guy. This would, trigger public sympathy or at least some discontent among the public.
Yeah, Rocky syndrome meaning the underdog. Supporting the underdog.
Look, no, but I mean sympathy with the militants or the fighters or whatever we may term them in Fallujah. The sympathy with them is not that big. Perhaps even inside their own communities. There is a silent majority. Right. We should know that there is a silent majority. But I mean, when you start a campaign and lots of innocent people die, people start to think, well. These are not the insurgents. These are not the, and you lose the public relation battle, if you like. You lose that kind of legitimacy that you have to bring those who did the killings of the four American civilians before the court of law. You lose that legitimacy. You lose that sympathy with the public, and you lose the confidence of the governing council. And why on earth should you start two episodes at one and the same time, creating a basis for the unity of the two extreme currents on both of the communal divide, both sides of the communal divide? Why should you do that? And why should you? Why shouldn't you start first with what's more reasonable? That's to liaise with the public, explain the problem, mobilize them, advise the governing council, start some negotiations to hand over those who are the culprits, and make the whole thing as peaceful as you can. And if you have to resort to military means, it should be the last resort, not the first resort. I mean, this is the process that should have been the exact opposite of what has happened, or what has happened thus far.
Well, but give us a sense, though. I mean, obviously, the U.S. has been heavy-handed in this thing, and from the entire episode, you never quite understand how they could have got it so wrong. But there is clearly just palpable anger everywhere. I mean, so how much is it? How much do the? I mean, I can't imagine what would happen if, say, the U.S. pulled out tomorrow. It would seem to me that they'd just cede the field to Saadat's militia and the leftover Baathis and the people that have been coming in, the Wahhabis and others, and you'd have a bloodbath. But on the other hand, it seems to me that every time you look at the television and you see these people, you know, celebrating with burning American vehicles in the background,
yeah,
I get the feeling that that the U.S.
How many hundreds?
Yeah, I just think, can't this thing reach a critical mass at a certain point where just this, you know, 25 million Iraqis would just say, we don't care, we had it. And then you'll have 130,000 Americans surrounded by 25 million angry people.
Well, I mean, as I said, violent currents are still fringe currents. But they, I mean, the borders between them and a peaceful majority is always, I mean, this border is always shifting.
Well, and the peaceful majority...
It will continue to shift either way.
Yeah. And presumably the peaceful majority, if it stays behind locked doors, right? They're not going to go out on the street.
I've just, over the phone, interviewed two independent individuals coming from Baghdad. And they testified that a great majority hates this kind of violence. They don't trust militias. They want to see the militias out. But they also disapprove of the methods of the CPA. You see the point? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very crucial point, indeed. And I think you can see this sentiment, this position, this attitude reflected very, very keenly in the fatwa issued by Sistani. Ayatollah Sistani's fatwa is very important. It was issued on Monday. Uh-huh. He denounced violence. He denounced occupation of public offices. He denounced attacks on civilians. He denounced this. But he also criticized severely the harsh methods used by the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority. And this is the exact mood. And the way you deal with it, the way you deal with the Iraqi public opinion, with the Iraqi, political forces, the extent to which you show respect for Iraqi nationalism, you can go forward smoothly. Otherwise, everybody would suffer.
Well,
this
I think
is my logic.
Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Fela Jabbar.
My pleasure.
And we'll stay in touch.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, Amy and Masters. I'm just speaking there with Fela Jabbar, who's a senior fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. He's also a research fellow at the School of Politics and Sociology at the University of London and the author of The Shiite Movement in Iraq. I'm now speaking with Dilip Hero, who is in London. He's the author of a new book, Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. And Dilip Hero, given that you've got an armed militia of Muqtadir al-Sadr's, you've got a substantial uprising in Fallujah of the Sunni, and our previous guest said, you know, I mean, it's almost boneheaded on the part of the United States. He didn't say that, but I'm paraphrasing, that they could have actually created linked these two movements who have nothing in common and hate each other in kind of formed a coalition against them, as it were. So what's going to happen here? Because the guys in the street are, if they take over, we know what a disaster it's going to be. But on the other hand, the Coalition Provisional Authority seem to be blundering in such a way that they're not giving anybody any hope that they know how to get out of this mess. They seem to be digging a deeper hole. So do you see any hope here?
Yeah, I think it's interesting the word coalition is being thrown around. I mean, that a coalition is basically Anglo-Americans. Of course, other people have 80, 90, 100 non-combat soldiers or engineers. I don't think that's really a proper coalition. But the main point here is fairly simple, which is that, you know, there are two parts to what is essentially called Anglo-American invasion of Iraq. Now, we're not going into it whether it was justified or not justified. The first part was overthrow of Saddam Hussein. That has been done, and of course, very Shiites were generally happy about it, and Kurds were happy about it. The Sunnis, I could say, were divided. Now, the second part is to turn post-Saddam Hussein into a client state of America. And that has unfolded itself. All one has to do is to look at the transitional constitution, which was signed about a month ago by the governing council, all of whom are appointed by the occupying power of the USA. And secondly, it has been made absolutely clear that the newly created Iraqi army will be under the command of CENTCOM, the U.S., the Pentagon. And it has been made absolutely clear that the Central Bank of Iraq will be supervised by the USA. It has been made absolutely clear that the oil policy will be decided by the USA. So what is going to happen if it happens? Big if. But if it happens, just because the gentleman now vacationing in Crawford, Texas, wants it that way, on the June 30th, if there is this so-called transfer of sovereignty to a group of Iraqis who don't know who they are or who they will be a charade. That is, they will have a maximum limited powers only to run domestic administration. They will have no power over the foreign policy, over the defense policy, over the oil policy of their own country. To that is related to what's happened now.
Sure.
You see, the Sunnis, as I said earlier, were divided, overthrow of Saddam. Of course, we know about Fallujah, et cetera, et cetera. But one has to understand some very simple basic things. As you know, I'm sure right now in America, this movie, which won the documentary prize Oscar, The Fog of War, is being shown, where you have Robert McNamara, who was in charge of running the Vietnam War for 8 years. He has said two things worth repeating, because this is what's happening now. He said, we had no empathy with the Vietnamese who were fighting us. And secondly, we did not know anything about the culture and history of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Exactly the same thing is happening now. Can you imagine non-Arab, non-Muslim soldiers going into Fallujah because four Americans were killed and mutilated, therefore to punish 300,000 people in a large city like Fallujah just for those four people? Of course, that was deplorable, but the question is, what force is being used? Overwhelming force is being used against ordinary citizens, in the course of which 450 civilians have been killed. So I think what I'm trying to say is that the approach here, this is a peacekeeping part of Iraq, you know, and the Marines are applying as if they are fighting a conventional army. The use of Apache helicopters, the use of 500-pound bombs being dropped on a mosque by F-16s. So I think that gives us the understanding of what's going on, you know, and this makes things worse. The whole idea is to win hearts and minds of people, and how do you expect this will happen? Of course, you can deploy, you know, what you call overwhelming force. Okay, maybe for 2-3 weeks, this thing will calm down and people go underground. It'll come up again.
Well, let's just, try. I have a sort of a deeper question, if you will. I know that the things screw up. I know that everything that they shouldn't have gone in there in the first place. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know anything about this country. They're not obviously not particularly welcome there. But it is a broken, wounded country. And I'm trying to get a sense my feeling is that the United States is going to get driven out of there at any rate. So there's not going to be any victory. There's probably going to be a massive defeat. And these mini Alamos all over the country that will pin down all of our people. And at a certain point, the entire country seems to be going to rise up against them. And now we know that the CPA are a bunch of carpetbaggers, and they basically got their fist in the U.S. Treasury. Then none of them are qualified. They're not doing anything except hunkering down behind razor wire and draining the U.S. Treasury. And we know also that this new government, the governing council, is a puppet regime. They basically have no authority except to sign the checks, which the same checks that Jerry Bremer is signing now, a group of people are going to be signing, but the real power will reside with the United States. But to what end? I mean, it seems, to use that phrase, we're between a rock and a hard place here.
Yeah, I think
you've got a bunch of bad guys waiting to take over, who will just, they'll be just bloodletting and a complete catastrophe. And then you've got the status quo, where you've got people who seem incapable of delivering peace and security and even a standard of living not even commensurate with the one that they had under Saddam, and under sanctions.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Okay, see, economic situation has grown worse, and secondly, at least under the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, people had security. Even women could go out at night at 1 a.m., nobody touched them. Now, the point is, in fact, what you said in your first question, where do we go from here? Yes, I think on this I did write an op-ed in the New York Times, which is appeared November 16, which says a better army for Iraq, which is this. You see, Zoghbi International carried out a very interesting survey, and of course, since Zoghbi is an Arab American, and so he has, and his people employed by them, they had much better understanding, and they asked the question about exactly who can be peacekeepers. His survey found three interesting things. One was that 51% of the people in Iraq said democracy will not work here because it's a Western concept. Okay, that's one. Secondly, that particular poll showed that 47% of Iraqis are prepared to accept, in quote, Arab forces as peacekeepers. Now, I'm being very specific because this is, again, another piece that I did, which appeared in January 27 in the New York Times op-ed, in which I said that this problem or this mess that Bush and, remember, Mr. Blair as well, okay, Mr. Blair have, together created for the world, has to be deposited at the door of UN Security Council with the first statement. Opening paragraph would be, we, the Anglo-Americans, are going to pull out every single soldier from Iraq by such and such date. They have to give the date up front, and then they have to Security Council, you take it off. What I'm saying is, again, please don't misunderstand me. It's not a fantasy. Remember, because I have done 15 books on the Middle East, one of which is called Dictionary of the Middle East. There's a history of Palestine. When Palestine was under the British mandate, they had the problems, of course, Arab Jews fighting, et cetera, and Israelis or Jews attacking the British, et cetera. And the British government said to the then United Nations General Assembly that we are leaving on May 15, 1948. And that is exactly what is required now. And once the Anglo-Americans say we are going to leave for such and such date, pull out every single soldier, and Security Council takes over. But remember, the UN has a bad name too. It was under the UN that people suffered 13 years of sanctions. Because of the sanctions, their living standards went down by, take a deep breath, 90%, 90%. Mm-hmm. Now, if the UN Security Council has this baby, this problem, and then if they look around the world and say, who is going to give us soldiers for peacekeeping, and if they are Europeans, if they are non-Muslim, non-Arab, forget it. then the security
Well, but that's not going to happen.
At the last bit, they have to go to the Arab League mm-hmm. and the Islamic Conference Organization to say, can you please send people for, as peacekeepers, not as occupiers? And then Iraqis need 2 to 3 years to work out a permanent constitution while their peacekeeping is done by fellow Arabs, fellow Muslims. See, that is something one has to understand. I can say I have been studying Iraq for the past 25 years. I've done 4 books on Iraq. I can say that Iraqis will never, never, never accept non-Arab, non-Muslim troops in their country as occupiers or as peacekeepers. And when you...
Well, we can tell that. We know that's the case from what's happening now. But let me just, in the last minute here... I mean, it's a good idea, and obviously